Okay, in Revelation chapter 16, beginning in verse 17, we are looking at this seventh bowl of the bowls of wrath. I remind you of this quote from Linsky: "The seven seals reveal, the seven trumpets announce and warn, and the seven bowls execute God's wrath." And so we are to the execution of that wrath stage with these giant golden bowls that are filled with the wrath of God that are going to be poured out on the unrighteous to bring total and complete judgment on those in Rome who were persecuting these who were Christians. So in verse 17, "Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, 'It is done.'" So we see that the first poured it out upon the earth, and the second poured it out on the sea, the third poured it out on the rivers and springs. And so if you had contact with any of those things, then there was destruction that was coming with them. Well, what's left in all of that? If you somehow managed to escape the earth and the sea and the rivers and everything else, what's left? The air. And if it's poured out in the air, is there anywhere to escape? No. It covers all of the ungodly now, wherever they are. The plagues were completed, and God's righteous judgment against this wicked nation would now be complete. And I remind you that these seven bowls of wrath are in many ways just a repeating of these seven trumpets that we saw. And so now we are to the seventh. It is done. Babylon is made to drain the cup of fury of God's wrath, and then there are these hailstones that are about to come. And so if we keep reading there in verse 18, "And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings and a great earthquake, such a mighty and great earthquake as had not occurred since men were on the earth." The greatest earthquake that has ever been or ever would be. The judgments of God toward this nation are going to be earth-shattering, if you will excuse the pun. It is beyond man's comprehension that a great nation like Rome, could fall. Who in here remembers the fall of the Soviet Union? Clearly. How exciting, but also unbelievable was it that this nation just kind of caved in upon itself, right? Well, the reality is that happens with every nation eventually. But certainly if God is the one bringing that judgment, and it will fall just like America is going to fall if the world continues until that time. And so too, it's earth-shattering to imagine the Roman Empire, this greatest nation, falling, and yet that's exactly what it's going to be like. So verse 19, "Now the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath." The great Babylon was a world city just like Rome of the Roman Empire. A total destruction from the Lord of this great city and nation is indicated. And God's cup of mercy, his cup of mercy is empty. His cup of wrath is full to overflowing, and it's going to be directed toward this wicked nation. "Then every island fled away, and the mountains were not found." This reminds me of the unrighteous, if we go back there to the seals, right? What did the unrighteous call for the mountains to do? Fall on us. Why? Because we want to hide. We want to escape. There's no escape. The mountains can't fall on you. You can't escape off to the mountains. You can't be like Tom Hanks and find a deserted island somewhere where you're going to escape the judgment. No, the islands have fled. The mountains have fled. It's in the air, it's on the earth, it's in the rivers, it's in the lakes, it's in the sea. God's judgment is coming, and it is inescapable. Verse 21, "And great hail from heaven fell upon men, each hailstone about the weight of a talent." Anybody have a different translation? Weight of a talent means nothing to us. About 100 pounds. If you had to guess, how big of a hailstone is that? 100-pound hailstone. Okay, I've got, somebody did this. All right, what else? This? Maybe? Well, let's see. Who's seen a hailstone this big? Golf ball sized hail. I'm from West Texas, man. I've seen this big. Who has seen this big? Baseball sized. I'm from West Texas, man. I've seen this big, right? This would be a little bit less than half a pound. Could that do some damage? A little bit less than half a pound is baseball sized hail. The largest hail that was ever recorded in America was this size, about eight inches across. How much do you think it weighed? 32 pounds. That is a great guess, especially if you take the three off. It weighed 2 pounds. Now, you may reach maximum velocity falling from the sky. What happens if this hits you in the head? That's all she wrote, right? Turn off the lights, the party's over. Just bounce off. Well, Ted is Iron Man back there. He has protection in the head that the rest of us don't have. 100-pound hailstone. I measured this off earlier. Mike, would you stand up, please? Stand up, please. And let's see. Rance, stand up, please. That is approximately 33 feet from Rance to Mike, right there. And based on my calculations, if we're talking about a 100-pound hailstone, 2 pounds, that's the diameter of a 100-pound hailstone. Y'all may sit. Am I sure? Well, I'm pretty sure. I checked it twice. Made a list, checked it twice. We think about that. Let me make this point first. We think about that. Is that ever going to happen in real life? No. But that's not the point, is it? Point is, when God judges, there is no escape. We all must give an account. Rome was going to give an account for the persecution of these Christians. Everyone who persecutes Christians are going to have to give an account. And every Christian is going to have to give an account as well for the things we have done in the body, whether they be good or whether they be evil. God's judgment is inescapable. All right, David, what was your comment? So the way I computed it, if y'all want to know that, if this 8 inches across was just less than 2 pounds, how much would it be if it were 100 pounds? That's the way I computed that. Okay, so you can check my math outside of class. Even if it is 10 times bigger than this, it still has the same effect, right, of what we're talking about here. And so, even with the severity of these plagues, as we have mentioned several times over the last couple of chapters, how does this chapter end? Men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since that plague was exceedingly great. Still, they do not repent. And so, even in the light of all of this, may I say, even in the light of God sending His Son to die on a cross and rising from the dead, there will be those whose heart is such that they will not repent. All right, thoughts or comments there before we get into chapter 17 tonight? Going once. So we got to keep in mind that this is not describing natural phenomenon that actually happened. That this is symbolic of how complete God's judgment is going to be. And so as we read these things, we're not looking for something that actually happened. We're getting the imagery and metaphor that's used to show this is what God's judgment is going to be like. Yeah, in the imagery, there's nothing that's going to turn them back to their Creator if that's the way their heart is. Like Pharaoh, who literally saw these plagues, and we don't know exactly how big those hailstones were, but they were supernatural, miraculous hailstones with Pharaoh. And yet what did he do over and over and over? He still hardens his heart in the light of all of this, in the light of his magician saying, look, this is the hand of the gods. This isn't fake. This is real. Even still, he hardened his heart over and over and over again. So, literally, that's what happened. Symbolically, that was what was going to happen with these in the Roman Empire as well. Okay, let's get into chapter 17 now. That's a picture of that hailstone, that real hailstone, the biggest that was ever recorded. It was actually in the 2000s, maybe a decade ago or something. Now, as we get through 17, 18, and 19, what we see here is judgment. And judgment, well, that's a shock, isn't it? We see judgment. We've had 16 chapters that have judgment in it. But specifically, it's judgment on the great harlot, who I suggest is also the great beast, who is also Babylon the Great. And so these are three images for this same entity, this same identification. And I would suggest, as we look here in chapter 17, this is a difficult chapter. It's a difficult chapter to put your finger on. But I would suggest that it's the most difficult chapter to explain if you take the early date for the events in Revelation and saying this is all about the destruction of Jerusalem. Because, as I suggested to you last time, we see some indications in this chapter, okay, this is not just symbolic. There are real things that this is tied to. Now, identifying what those real things are is very difficult for us. I would suggest it would have been much easier for the original recipients of the book of Revelation. But it does indicate to us, okay, who exactly is this talking about? And for my perspective and my study, we're talking about Rome at the end of the first century under Domitian. That is our identification of the time period where these things are taking place. So let's read beginning there in verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. Now, this is symbolic, but I want you to walk you through something here. Sitting on many waters, does that in any way describe Jerusalem? No. Jerusalem's landlocked way up in the mountains. If you wanted to get something to the ocean, you had to put it on carts and take it down. Does it describe Rome? Does Rome sit on many waters? Well, the trade routes that come from Rome would suggest that yes, from the Mediterranean you can go to a lot of different places. But, rightfully so, people say, well, this is symbolic. Well, what is it symbolic of? And that's the interesting thing about chapter 17. Beginning in verse 7, we have some explanations of some of these things. Now, the explanations aren't always more helpful than even what the symbolism is, but it does tell us, okay, there's something that this is supposed to stand for. Verse 15 of chapter 17, then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. Does that describe Jerusalem? Well, maybe you could twist that a little bit and say, okay, the Jews go off everywhere and we see that sort of thing. But if we're really talking about ruling over many nations and tongues, as we see earlier in the book, that wouldn't fit with Jerusalem. What's interesting to me, as I said, you get to verse 7, but the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. So there's an interpretation given here. It's similar to what we see with the seven lampstands back there in chapter 1 and verse 20. For some reason, I turned to Genesis 1. That's a little bit too far back. Revelation 1 and verse 20. The mystery of the seven stars, there's that word mystery that we see in verse 5 of chapter 17. The mystery of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. And the seven lampstands which you saw are the seven churches. Now, one of those is very helpful to us. They are the seven churches. Well, that's pretty easy, right? Okay, we know exactly what that is. But then the angels of the seven churches, even what it stands for, the reality, well, there's some ambiguity there. What exactly are we talking about? And I would say we see certainly the same thing here in chapter 17. It's difficult to sort out. But the point I want to make is that we are closer to something physical and literal in these verses than almost anywhere else as we go through these cycles. And those in the first century would have been equipped to see these things and recognize these things a little bit better. But a couple of things that stand out. Verse 9. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. If I said to you, the Big Apple, what city am I talking about? New York City. If I said to you, the Windy City, Chicago, Illinois, right? If, even today, but certainly in the ancient world, if I said to you, the city on seven hills, that's Rome, right? And some have tried to take this and say, well, there's seven hills in Jerusalem. That just doesn't work. We see that there are these seven hills on which Rome was founded. It's known as the City of Seven Hills. The interesting thing is, these hills also stand for kings. And so we'll get to that here in just a second. But before we do, let's notice verse 18 as well. And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Maybe you could say there was one time in history that Jerusalem as the capital was the most powerful nation on earth during the days of Solomon. But at no time did it rule over the kings of the earth, certainly not in the same sort of way that Rome did. And so I think we see some glimpses here that perhaps point us in that direction that we have suggested. But let's go back and let's see the imagery now. So we've read verse 1. Go back to verse 2. So she sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. And the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet. Who else had a scarlet and purple robe put on them? Jesus did. And who did that? The Jews? Herod at first, and then the Romans did that. Yes. And so for them, it was a mockery because that represents what? Royalty and power. She's adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. Now there's lots of symbolism there with this being written on her forehead. We think about the high priest. He had something on a band on his forehead, holy to the Lord, right? Here is just the opposite of that. We think about in the ancient world when a slave, especially a rebellious slave, really got out of line, they would brand them right there on their forehead so that everybody knew exactly who they were and that they were dangerous, what they had done. And so this harlot has this on her forehead. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. The harlot, I believe, again, is the Roman Empire. And how is Rome depicted in Roman literature? The city of Rome is depicted as a woman, as a goddess, as Roma, who is this woman right here. She has a helmet, a battle helmet on her head. She has a spear in her hand. And then this ball right here is intended to be the world. that Rome held the world in her hand, and she did so by her might, she did so by her military prowess, and she rules the world and wages war. Roma was intended to be a personification of the city of Rome. And it's interesting that they didn't really worship Roma in Rome itself. They worshiped Roma in these provinces. And we look at the seven churches of Asia, we've found archaeological evidence that many of them, at least, had temples to Roma in these cities. And the vision takes this imagery of this woman, but this woman is a what? She's a what? She's a harlot. This is an adult class. She's a whore. She's a prostitute. And she has prostituted herself with the world. She may rule, but she rules through her abominations and the filthiness of her fornications. This woman has spread her evil everywhere. Everyone has drunk of her harlotry. And notice her brand on her forehead, her description is what? Mystery, Babylon the Great. Is that a compliment? Well, not if you're trying to be right in the eyes of God, right? We go back to the Old Testament imagery. Babylon is in many ways personified as this evil city, this evil empire. And she is the mother of harlots. If I got stuck in Houston traffic or LA traffic and I called Stephanie, I said, I'm in the mother of all traffic jams. What am I saying by that? I'm not going to get home very soon. It's bad. This is really, really bad, right? Well, she is the mother of all harlots. She is the model and ultimate example of this kind of harlotry. And so that's the image. Now the interpretation, beginning in verse 7, again, in some ways just as confusing. But the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast which you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth. Okay, so now we have an eighth coming out here, and is of the seven and is going to perdition. So let's stop right there in verse 11 for just a second. This is why the book of Revelation is so confusing. We have a symbol which has an explanation, which is a reality, but is also a symbol, maybe, because that also is a symbol of something else. So we have the ten heads, which are ten hills, which are also seven heads. I'm going to get this right. All right. We have seven heads, which are seven hills or mountains, which are seven kings, right? And so we have this kind of layers of symbolism and reality, and trying to get all of that straight is pretty difficult. But let's try and, you know, pick on some edges and pull some strings that might help us a little bit. Mountains are symbolic in the Old Testament of strength, of an empire, which leads us to the idea of these mountains being kings. Who are these kings? Who are these seven kings? Well, there are lots of explanations that are given. Here's a list of the Roman Empire, starting with Augustus. And so if we do it this way, then we have seven plus the eighth, who is the really bad one, who is the beast. That would be Domitian if we put it in this way. Five have fallen through Nero, one is. Some say, okay, so that means the dating of the book is during Vespasian. Another who has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while. That's Titus. And then the beast who was and is not is himself also an eighth and is of the seven. He goes to destruction. That's Domitian. problem with that is, during these years, Vespasian and Titus, there was really not persecution of Christians. So that gives us a problem. Others have said, well, we need to start our list with Julius Caesar. None of the Roman historians do that, but hey, he was the first Caesar, if we want to think about it in those terms. Okay, so now we move all this up. So five have fallen, one is, and that's Nero. And so this is talking about during the time of Nero and the destruction of Jerusalem. So we have Vespasian, who led the destruction of Jerusalem, but then Titus came along and finished that off. Well, that seems to fit pretty well until we realize there is judgment coming against these kings. They are not the source of God's judgment on somebody else. And so that gives us a problem. Others, Haley puts it this way, these seven kings are a symbol of secular anti-Christian power. They represent all kings or kingdoms, past, present, and future, that would oppose the kingdom of God. Well, maybe, but we already said we're getting closer to reality in these chapters. The answer is this. I don't know. I lean toward this idea that no exact kings are intended, but it's a seven, another seven. So that's perfect, right? And so it is a representation of the power of Rome up to this point, that Rome has this perfect power up to this point, but it's not going to stay that way. And this phrase here, that this beast and this king, what do we see there in verse 7 and 8? The beast that was and is not, and yet is. That's very similar to a phrase that we see earlier in the book of Revelation to describe Jesus. Jesus is described as what? He was and is to come. Now, just one thing has changed from that. This beast was and is not and is to come. I think there's an echo there, or I would suggest maybe there's an echo there, that again, these emperors are trying to imitate divinity. They're trying to imitate God. But ultimately, the answer is they are not. They think they are, but they are not. And so ultimately, yes, it is describing the power of Rome that imitates and acts like God, but it is not God. And now Domitian is here, the eighth of this, and he is more arrogant than all who are before him in these things. And so that would be my best explanation of those things. Now, somebody could punch holes in that, just like I've punched holes in the others. But I think that maybe gives us a glimpse of that. The overall picture is of the power and reign of the Roman Empire. There's no arguing that. That power would eventually collapse and be eaten away from those who were supposed to be its minions, as we see in verse 12 and following. The ten horns, which you saw, are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, and he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot. Wait a second, I thought they ruled with her. They do, but they hate her. Make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So we see these ten kings who, they don't have really any real power. They just reign with the beast. I would suggest those represent those Roman provinces, just as we've seen in times past with the dragon who is the devil, the beast from the sea, which is Rome, and then the beast of the land, which is the rulers in these provinces. I think it's that same idea. And so it's made up of those conquered peoples who have been made wealthy by Rome, but in actuality they hate her, like Herod and others who were kings, but let's be honest, they were just under the Roman Empire. Harkrider says this, Though they join with her in persecuting the saints, they are really after selfish interests. They enjoy the luxuries that Rome gives, but they serve only for the political and economic advantages. With double-facedness, they pretend to honor her, but with jealousy, they actually despise Rome. Doesn't that describe those provinces? They were glad to have the prosperity and money they made, but when the opportunity came to turn around and consume Rome, that's exactly what they did. There's certainly an application to be made for our friendships with the world. Why is someone in a relationship with me? We should probably ask ourselves that, shouldn't we? Is it purely or even mostly selfish reasons that they have a relationship with me? Well, we should know that that kind of relationship rarely ends well, which is what is so beautiful about our relationship with God and what should be so beautiful about our relationship with our brethren, that each of us puts the needs of our brethren above our own. And instead of serving our own selfish interest, looking where we can stab somebody in the back if it puts us ahead, that's not the way it works at all for us. But that's the way it works with the world. That's the way it was going to work for the Roman Empire as well. All right, so what we really do is continue in chapter 18 with the same idea, just put in a different way. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. So there, here things are revealed. We can see it. And just like there were seven kings plus one more, an eighth, we've had seven angels with bowls of wrath. Now we have an eighth come along. There's a parallel there. And here is the angel's proclamation. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. This is what it has become. We see the city of heaven is a place where righteousness dwells. This is a place where all this other stuff dwells. How many times does he say it has fallen? Twice. Which emphasizes that this is a big deal. This is a big fall. This isn't a slip. They've been knocked down. I'm reminded of Howard Cosell's famous call in the George Foreman-Frazier fight. You know, down goes Frazier, down goes Frazier, down goes Frazier. Why did he say it three times like that? Because Frazier was down, and he might get back up and stumble along in the fight a little bit more, but it was really over. And that was going to be the case here with the Roman Empire as well. So in verse 3, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. So the call to Christians is what? Don't be part of the world. Don't go down with this ship. It's a sinking ship. It might seem like they're winning right now, but that's not going to be the case. And so you need to have complete separation from the sins of this world. Everybody else is drunk of her fornication, but not you. You're not going to be corrupted by her lust. And by doing this, they could escape these plagues sent by God. And we think about some of those great passages in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 17, where we don't have fellowship with the world. Ephesians 5 and verse 11, we don't have fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but we rather expose them. And the reality for the sin of Rome provides a sharp contrast in verses 5 and following. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. We think about a smell reaching heaven. Well, it's a stench, right? God smells all of this, and he's going to judge them. Verse 6, render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix double for her. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen and am no widow and will not see sorrow. The measure of Rome's sin will be a double measure of her punishment from God. The measure of her exaltation was the measure of her abasement. Rome was arrogantly unrealistic about their plight. They were in trouble and they didn't even know it. Notice, witnessing the ultimate collapse of her nation, she calls herself what? I sit as a queen. Yeah, queen of a nation that's falling. She's seeing the ultimate death and destruction of her people, and she says what? I am no widow. I still have my family. While others are going to be mourning over the death of a nation, she says what? I will see no sorrow. Everything's just fine, and it's going to be just fine. Nothing is going to change with my sin. I'm going to continue to rule. Therefore, her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. When judgment and punishment comes from the great God, Rome will face the reality of death, mourning, famine, and destruction by fire. Is there an application? You better believe it. Isn't that the way everyone who is stuck in sin is? Everything's okay. No problems here. It's like the famous meme. This is fine. As their world is burning all around them. That's not just true of Rome. That's true of everyone who is deceived by sin. Until the last possible moment, we want to hang on and think, no, everything's okay. What we need to do is wake up before it's too late. A life in sin, no matter how long, how rich, how powerful, how pleasurable, how seemingly untouchable as the nation of Rome, it will be judged. Then what? Well, I don't know about you, but I'm going to be ready. Because I'm going to be on the Lord's side. Thank you for your good attention tonight. We'll finish chapter 18 and look at chapter 19 next week.